Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, May 15th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from New York Oncology Hematology, sponsoring the Spring to Life Conference May 20th at the Albany Marriott, including the afternoon session on caregiving for cancer patients. NewYorkOncology.com for information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Frank Genovese of Ellis Medicine. He's here to answer your questions about a range of neurological issues. He's a neurosurgeon. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in early. And the number to call, as you all know, is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Genovese, your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Frank Genovese, a neurosurgeon practicing out of Ellis Hospital in Schenectady, New York. Dr. Genovese earned his medical degree at Chicago Medical School. He treats people for a variety of neurological issues. Dr. Genovese, welcome to the Medical Monday.
Good afternoon, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so, Dr. Genovese, I guess the first question I have is that you are a neurosurgeon. And you're not a neurologist. You give us an example of what you might do in a day.
Sure. A neurosurgeon is a surgeon who treats neurological problems or issues, i.e. someone who operates on the brain, the spinal cord, peripheral nerves, or problems related to a structural issue. The neurologist, on the other hand, is my medical counterpart. He will do more of the medical neurological issues, for example, seizures, MS, movement disorders, so on.
But if something comes along in which you can use a scalpel to cure MS, you'll be in it.
That is correct. If MS is curable with a scalpel, which we know it is not, but that is correct.
Okay, I guess I deserve that. So, Frank, if I can, the next question is, do you see people for neurological disorders that might go to a neurologist?
Yes, we do. In fact, we typically see sometimes patients with Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonian-like features that can be misconstrued as a problem with neural compression causing movement disorders. Sometimes something like an MS plaque, multiple sclerosis plaque, can cause a very focal finding that can be misconstrued as a neurosurgical problem, i.e. a focal lesion pushing in on a specific nerve. So we have to be very careful. ALS is another one that we have to be very careful of when dealing with cervical disc disease.
Well, in some cases, for example, let me give you one. Parkinson's, which you just mentioned, there have been implants, brain implants, in Parkinson's disease. Do you do that?
I do not. However, there are neurosurgeons that do what we call functional neurosurgery. They clearly are involved with what we call deep brain stimulation that may have a role in certain people with movement disorders.
Okay, so we'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, welcome back, Jim.
Thanks. Are there any specific neurological lesions generated by tick-borne diseases?
I'm sorry, sir, by what?
Generated by
tick-borne diseases.
Tick-borne diseases.
As a general rule of thumb, my understanding is that tick-borne diseases, i.e. Lyme disease, of course, being one of the first and foremost, generally present with a serological problem, i.e. a blood problem whereby the body produces antibodies that can affect various organ systems. Therefore, a specific lesion with regards to a specific tick-borne entity, in my opinion, is very, very rare. And I'm not familiar other than the local effect that the tick bite might have on a neurological system.
Thank you, Jim from Matamoros. Okay, we've got a Sandy in Albany. Sandy, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Okay, so, Doctor, I understand that there's a CGRP antagonist that's somewhere in the FDA trials. I have two parts to my question. One is, do you know where it is and how soon we can expect it for migraines? And number two is, I understand that frequently there are medications that are approved abroad before the U.S., and so I'm wondering if we might be able to see it being used abroad first.
Well, Sandy, again, it sounds more like a neurological issue, i.e. migraine, than it is a neurosurgical issue. And as you know, I'm a neurosurgeon. There's no question that the latter part of your question, clearly, many times the Europeans have a head start on us for a variety of reasons. I am not familiar with the first part of your question.
Okay, I'm sorry. When I first called in, I understood that you were a neurologist, not a neurosurgeon, so I understand.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Appreciate your understanding. Okay. And now we'll go to Martin in Cohoes. Martin in Cohoes, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And doctor.
Hello, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Doctor, this is Kismet. My son is in the IC unit at Methodist Hospital for an infection that settled in his spine. It's a staph infection, and it caused a fracture, and they operated to take the pressure off of the spine, and he has no use of his legs at the moment, but he does have some movement in his toes, which they say is encouraging. My question is, what are the chances that the antibiotics are going to eradicate the staph infection so that it doesn't continue to hurt other parts of his spine?
Yes. Well, Martin, I'm sorry to hear about the situation, but really the bottom line in this case from my standpoint is that whether or not they've isolated the organism, and you did say it was a staph infection, there are many different types of staph species, but they may or may not be related to methicillin resistance, certain antibiotic resistances. So you have to do a study such that you need to find out the sensitivity. With regards to the fracture, and the neurological complication. The question in my mind is whether or not the fracture caused the collapse and retropulsion of bone into the neural elements. And of course, with that being the case, if that was in fact the case, it's anyone's guess as to what kind of neurological recovery he will or will not have. There are different classifications of injury, and I'll refer you to the ASIA system, A-S-I-A, which it sounds like he may be either a B or a C, clearly not an A, and I'm optimistic and hopeful, as you probably are made well aware that sometimes neurological injuries of such can take upwards of 18 plus months to find out what kind of benefit there are. With regards to infections elsewhere in the spine, hopefully if the antibiotic has full coverage, it will take care of any other infection related to that specific organism.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. Okay. Now we went from Martin. Let's go to another Martin, this time in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Okay, Martin in Pittsfield, you're on.
Hello, doctors.
Hello, Martin.
I about 18 or 20 years ago, I suffered a front lobal meningioma, which caused me to go, had a grand mal seizure. That's how it was diagnosed. I had no symptoms before that. It was completely removed, I remember, according to the doctor at Mass General. And I remember at the time he said it would be very unlikely that this would reoccur. So my questions are, Do you agree with that assessment? And also, should I be getting periodic MRI, do you think, to see if it in fact has been completely eradicated and not growing back?
I'm sorry, Martin, where did you say the meningioma was located?
The front lobe, my right front lobe.
Yeah, you are correct. As a
doctor, before you go on, could you just explain to everybody what those terms mean? Meningioma.
Yes, of course. Sorry. A meningioma typically is a benign tumor that arises from the arachnoid cap cells of the meninges. Generally speaking, these are benign, and once excised, they tend to not come back. But therein lies the catch. If they're totally excised, they will not come back. However, the caveat being that it could be an atypical meningioma, whereby the cells are more aggressive. But in a normal, if there is such, a routine meningioma, these are benign cells, benign tumor, when excised, are eradicated. However, my practice is yearly MRIs for about 5 years. So there's continued vigilance for about 5 years. After the fifth year, if there's no indication of recurrent tumor, then generally speaking, I let my patients decide whether or not they want to come back in 2 years, 4 years, or whatever.
Okay.
Thank you, Martin. Appreciate your call. Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, actsurg.com. Curran Compliance Services, Inc., Greenwich, New York, and Mendota Heights, Minnesota, providing DOL fiduciary rule compliance training and guidance to the life insurance carriers and their distribution partners, currancompliance.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie presenting Animals in Bronze, the Michael and Mary Erlinger collection of animalier bronzes from the Georgia Museum of Art, arkellmuseum.org. Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York, an open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat, holiday services, their religious school, cultural programs, and more, saratogasinai.org. And from Colby Attorney Service, Corporate Formations, Document Retrieval Services, Court Filings, and Legal Publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939, colbyservice.com.
And we are back with our friend, Dr. Frank Genovese, who is a practicing neurosurgeon. And now's a good time for you to call. Lots of free phones. We'll go to Karen in Scotia. Karen, you're on.
Hi. I have trigeminal neuralgia. I've been working with my neurologist with medication, and we've reached what he says is the end of the medication. And I'm curious. I've been looking into different surgical options. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are and also what the recovery times are for those options. And if I would still need to be on medication once those options have been done.
Okay, doctor, we'd also like you to explain the medical terms involved here. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Carol. Trigeminal neuralgia, for our listening audience, is a condition involving the trigeminal nerve, which is the fifth cranial nerve, and there are three main branches to the face. Typically, with a trigeminal neuralgia, there's an extreme, sharp, lancinating pain that will affect one of the three or two of the three branches of the trigeminal nerve. And as you correctly pointed out, the first treatment of choice would always be medical. You always want to try medication first, and typically this is polypharmaceutical. In other words, you have to take a lot of different medications. It's not just one. Tegretol, of course, being the medication first and foremost with trigeminal neuralgia, but that's not the only one. With regards to the surgical treatments of trigeminal neuralgia, there are basically several components. You can either block the nerve or temporarily causing it to become dysfunctional, so to speak. And one option would be something called a glycerin injection or an alcohol injection. And that, by the way, is falling by the wayside. Another potential and more common treatment surgically for trigeminal neuralgia involves something called a microvascular decompression. And we're finding out, and this is the pioneering work that came out of the University of Pittsburgh by Dr. Janetta, whereby a vessel, usually an arterial branch, either the posterior inferior cerebellar artery or the anterior inferior cerebellar artery, will push on the nerve directly at something called a dorsal root ganglion zone. And we find out that we're finding out that if you remove that vessel off of the nerve, you can remove many of the effects of trigeminal neuralgia. Now, that of course involves a surgical procedure, and that is not without risk. So it's much more invasive. But having said that, it is very successful in the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia after medications have failed.
Karen,
the second.
Can you say the name of that again? The last procedure you just.
MVD, which is called microvascular decompression. And the second question that I believe I heard was that you mentioned the recuperative time with that. Generally speaking, most craniotomies need a minimum of 4 to 6 weeks of post-op recuperation to heal effectively. But hopefully the results of the surgery will be immediate.
Thank you, Karen.
Immediate meaning no more meds.
No, typically, what I do in my practice is I will continue the medication for several months, slowly weaning them off of the medication to see and hopefully get them off of the medication eventually, but not immediately. You do not want to stop any anticonvulsants abruptly or quickly.
Okay.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You call now, and your call is guaranteed to get on the air. Okay, so, Dr. Genovese, I guess the next question from me is, do you work on discs?
Yes, sir.
So what do you do when you when you're working on a disc that causes, you know, lateral pain or whatever?
Well, first and foremost, as a surgeon treating cervical disc disease or lumbar disc disease, my first advice would be conservative treatment. You always want to give it time, try the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, conservative treatment including physical therapy and or epidural steroid injections. And of course, we're talking about refractory to those conservative treatment.
What does that mean, refractory?
Refractory meaning that it does not respond to medical management, okay. i.e. pain medication, physical therapy, cortisone shots.
Okay, go ahead.
So from a surgical standpoint, then you have to decide, is surgery worth the risk or the benefit? Now, obviously, if you failed everything else and you're still in pain and you have a structural lesion, then surgery becomes an option. There are many different surgical approaches to treating disc disease, whether it's in the neck and or the back. But the bottom line is you're removing the offending material or fragment of disc material off of the nerve or neural element to get relief of pain.
Huh. Okay, thank you very much. Let's see. Can we go to Christine? We can. I don't see anything on line one, Joe. Okay. What, break? No. We didn't. Huh. Okay, yeah. Okay, Linda in Old Chatham. All right, Linda, you're on.
Hey, hi there. I was forced to stop an epileptic or anticonvulsant, I don't know if that's equivalent, called lamotrigine because of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. You don't want to keep taking that stuff after you've got a very clear allergic reaction, which I did. So what's the impact of something like that, of having to stop it abruptly?
Well, unfortunately, as you found out the hard way, Stevens-Johnson syndrome is one of the worst allergic reactions you can get to a medication.
It was no fun.
And I'm sorry you had to go through that. But the bottom line is what I would have done is you have to stop that medication immediately. I probably would have started you on another medication concomitant with stopping or tapering off the well, you can't really taper when you have Stevens-Johnson. You have to stop it abruptly. So I would start a second medication.
What would you have done to put in place, you know, as a to taper off.
Again, the underlying condition was what, Carol?
Oh, well, there wasn't anything. There wasn't a good reason to have prescribed it. It was supposed to be mood stabilizing to kind of enhance Paxil, but there wasn't really a lot of reasoning to do that. I wish I'd realized, or I would have refused to take it. But
I'm sorry. What was the underlying diagnosis?
Stabilization.
Christine.
Well, I didn't speak clearly enough.
I mean, Linda.
Mood stabilization. No, I don't have epilepsy. I don't have seizures.
I certainly would consult with a psychiatrist. They're much more versed in the medication aspect than I am as a surgeon.
I was in bad shape for over a month, and Stevens Johnson is no fun.
No.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Thanks a lot. So.
Thank you.
I've always had a question. These conditions are named after people like Stevens Johnson. Who is Stevens Johnson?
I don't have an answer for you. I'd be lying to you in making one up. However, as you correctly pointed out many times, a physician that either treats with it or first comes across the illness has the luxury of naming the illness.
As in Alzheimer's?
Yes, something similar along those lines. Although... there are many that that may or may not be correlative to the inventor of the illness.
Okay, good. Okay, we'll go to Christine, but not before I say 1-800-348-2551. Christine in Mount Tremper. Okay, Christine, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
My question is this. I have been diagnosed with benign essential blepharospasms and also Meigs syndrome. And I want to know if there's any other new treatment besides Botox and or some kind of drugs, and what caused this? It's really, I haven't gotten any clear indication as to what caused it. I can't keep my eyes open.
Yeah, that's a great
question.
And my
face squishes up, and I can't see, so... It's very uncomfortable. It's very frustrating. I was an avid reader. I can't read. Luckily, the Library for the Blind is taking care of that, you know.
Okay, Christine.
With a beautiful reader.
Christine, we're going to get an answer for you now. Go ahead, Doc.
Well, Christine, again, I'm sorry you had to go through this, but in my mind, is this truly a blepharospasm? And if it is, what is it secondary to? Could this be a trigeminal neuralgia variant with involving of the first branch, the ophthalmic branch of the trigeminal nerve? So I think...
I don't understand what that means.
Yeah, the bottom line is that we need to find out whether or not there's a structural lesion for this. And the best thing, in my opinion, would be if you have not had a structural, an imaging, for example, a CAT scan or an MRI, MRA of your head, that might be a good start.
I had an MRI.
Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between MRI and MRA. The MRA studies the blood vessels, and as I mentioned to a previous caller, sometimes blood vessels can push in on neural elements and cause problems. And the issue in my mind is, do you truly have blepharospasm, or is it an atypical facial pain, or is it in fact just a tic or spasmodic movement disorder? So this is something that I think you really need to speak with your neurologist and have them tease this out.
And what's a blepharospasm?
That's a spasm of the eyelid. That's where the eyelid will involuntarily contract, as in a twitching in your arm, the muscle in the eyelid.
It actually keeps my eyes closed for lengths of time.
Okay. Well, that's more of a tonic type contracture.
Christine?
Yeah, and my face gets all squeezed up and I look like I have an angry face.
Mm-hmm.
Christine, thank you very much for your call. Okay. All right. Now we will go to Lydia in Latham. 1-800-348-2551. Lydia in Latham, you're on.
Hi. I was diagnosed with idiopathic scoliosis at my kindergarten physical. I'm now 28. And after I... stopped growing when I was 19, my curve didn't stop progressing. I have an S curve in my spine. The top is 57 degrees. The bottom right now is at like 48. And I've pretty much come to the point where the surgeons say you have to have surgery, but like my pain level isn't so high that it's not every day. It doesn't affect me physically as much as I think to have the surgery. So I'm wondering what the risks are if I put the surgery off for, let's say, another 10 years because I'm 28 and probably healthier than I may be, or if it'll change the recovery process or anything like that if I wait too long.
Yeah. Again, Lydia, I don't know if the angles you mentioned to me are Cobb angles, which is the angle that the orthopedic surgeon typically measures, mentioning the degree of curvature. As a general rule of thumb, my feeling is that as long as you have an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon that is actively following you, and when I say actively, I mean not necessarily monthly, but at least maybe twice a year, that's very important to see how quickly these angles change. Number two, really the bottom line is your symptoms. I tell my patients, I don't care what they have from a radiological standpoint, what their images show, I tell my patients the pain will dictate whether or not you should consider surgery as an option. Now, you're a special case in the sense that you have a progressive scoliosis. So, you know, you can make an argument and say, well, let's nip this in the bud early because we know it's progressed. But again, I'm handicapped not knowing how fast those angles occurred. So you really need to follow up with the orthopedic or neurosurgeon, and your body has to dictate whether or not you're ready for the surgery or not. As you know, it's a formidable procedure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are great. Bob in Danbury, your turn. Okay, Bob, you're on.
Good afternoon. 1983, I had an operation on my back, L5-S1 laminectomy. 2 years ago, I had an operation where they fused 4-5. And I'm constantly having pain down my leg, numbness. It goes to both legs at times. I don't want to have an operation. At what point in time does the numbers, I have to take care of it? I can take the pain, but is there a point where a certain trigger says you got to have an operation?
Bob, was it?
Yes.
Yes. Well, Bob, no, there's nothing that says definitively you must have an operation at such and such. The bottom line is going to be how you feel and what your symptoms are. It is imperative to try all non-surgical forms of treatment first. It sounds like you had something called adjacent level disease, which occurs many times after a fusion happens with a surgery. The level above or below the fusion sometimes takes the brunt of the movements and therefore sets you up potentially for problems later on. The bottom line is your symptoms. When the symptoms interfere with your lifestyle, or you're tired or you can't tolerate the pain, then that's the time to seek a surgical management.
So just stay with my doctor and keep him up to date on how I'm feeling.
Yes, notwithstanding the other potential emergent conditions such as bowel or bladder issues, incontinence to urine or stool, sexual dysfunction related to the problem.
Right, right. No, I don't have that problem. I just got, you know, numbness down my leg. I don't want to have an operation because it hasn't worked, the operations for me.
Yeah.
And okay. I thank you for your time.
You're welcome, sir.
Bob Danbury. All right, let's go to Susan in Amherst. All right, Susan in Amherst. I love Amherst. Go ahead.
Hi. I have severe spinal stenosis, and I'm seeing the neurosurgeon next month. And the last time I saw one about 4 years ago when I had the same issue, recommended surgery, which I would like to avoid. But even if I do PT and, some steroid injections, I mean, the spinal column doesn't get any bigger. Is there, you know, how long can it last? Like, is it putting off surgery? Am I just putting off surgery?
Again, Susan, I'm handicapped not seeing your films, but you are correct in that spinal stenosis is a degenerative condition that never opens up on its own. It always progressively worsens. The key here is how fast will it worsen? Some people go many, many years and it doesn't progress at all. Some people progress within months to years. Not knowing the diameter of your canal, you have to say to yourself, I've tried everything else, i.e. physical therapy, cortisone shots, whether or not you've done chiropractic treatment and or acupuncture. Then you have to say, I can live like this or not. And
4 years ago, it was at 9 millimeters, and my last week's MRI, the report doesn't give me the numbers.
It's not going to be bigger than 9, I can assure you. It'll be either 9 or worse. So
yeah,
again,
the doctor said it's much worse than it's 4 years ago.
Yeah, you don't have much more play in the canal.
Okay.
So you're going to have to make a decision whether or not you want to proceed with surgery. Knowing full well, as a general rule of thumb, this type of surgery carries about an 85% overall success rate.
And they remove the lamen, which is what? Can you explain what the lamen is when they do? This is a laminectomy, right?
Yes, ma'am. That's what it sounds like. The lamina is the roof of the spinal canal. When you look at a vertebral body, you see the big, thick part of the vertebral body. Then that has a hole in the middle of it. That's where the neural elements go through. Then that hole has a roof on top of it. That roof is called the lamina, which needs to be removed to decompress the neural elements. At the very peak...
Does it ever grow back?
No. Well, no. It usually grows in with scar tissue. It does not grow back. So, no.
Okay.
The lamina does not come back. But the lamina is also connected to the spinous process, which has to be removed also, generally speaking.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back, and then we'll talk to Wayne and Ivy and Paul and a whole bunch of other people.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, announcing the opening of a new dialysis center in Gloversville for renal kidney care, NLH.org. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center, providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2017. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. And from Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, Old South Street, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Dairy and no-moo dairy-free, handmade artisan ice cream, sweet baked goods, hot fudge, and more. Harrells.com.
And rounding the corner for the last third of the program with Dr. Frank Genovese. And remember that what we're looking at here is the life of a neurosurgeon and what he does. And so a lot of people are getting on the phone right now, and that's good. All right, we'll go to, Wayne in East Greenbush. All right, Wayne, your turn.
Good afternoon. A relative of mine just recently sent me information about a recently approved drug from the FDA that may be useful in treating I think she said postpartum syndrome and maybe MS and maybe some other neurological diseases. And I'm wondering if you heard about that and whether or not you think that it has any possibility. And then related to that, what would you do if your neurologist is reluctant to go ahead with that, at least in the near future? And that's what I originally called for, but I wanted to quickly ask for a follow-up and what the risks are for that trigeminal neuralgia blood vessel procedure.
I'm sorry, Wayne. I heard two questions here. The first one was a follow-up on trigeminal neuralgia, and you had mentioned something to the effect of a drug treating what?
Some neurological diseases. I think there were MS, post-polio syndrome, and maybe something else.
Post-what syndrome?
Polio.
A post-polio syndrome? Yeah. Wayne, as a neurosurgeon, I rarely deal with drugs. You'd have to be speaking with the neurologist with regards to medication use, especially in disorders like MS. But from a neurosurgical standpoint, with the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia, again, you always want to start with medicine first, i.e. anticonvulsants, Tegretol, one of the other medications that might hopefully get rid of your symptoms. But if not, and everything else fails, then surgery becomes an option. And one of the options is what we call the microvascular decompression, where we stick a pledget of cotton or Telfa between the nerve and the offending blood vessel that's pushing in on the nerve.
Oh, okay, well, you said there were risks with some of the options for dealing with vascular blood vessel, or
yes, the microvascular decompression, of course, is a surgical procedure. Any invasion, any interventional procedures, i.e., surgery, even if it's non-surgical medication, everything has potential risks. You have to weigh the risks and the benefits, i.e., you have to determine whether or not your pain or your symptoms are such that you cannot or do not want to live this way.
So how can a guy... Okay,
question. Have you heard anything about laser or radiation treatment?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is something called the gamma knife. The gamma knife is not a surgical knife. It is a radiation procedure whereby 201 collimators of cobalt material are used to coalesce or condense on one specific spot, i.e. to burn out the nerve essentially. Many times that's used for tumors, small tumors pushing in on the trigeminal nerve or an acoustic neuroma, which pushes in on the hearing nerve. So sometimes radiation is good, but that's usually for tumor, not in the case of a blood vessel pushing in on the trigeminal nerve.
Okay. Thank you. Now, almost all of the things have disappeared from the my screen here. Don't ask me why, but they have. And so we'll be talking to the doctor. So, doctor, I just want to read you one email message. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, doctor. I listen to WAMC all the time, and I think it's important to have such extraordinary educational programs like this. I think maybe this is a different type of question than the doctor normally gets. But for all the brilliant young people in the area struggling to find purpose in a real career, how would you recommend one gets into neurosurgery if you've got a bachelor's, let's say, in psychology, especially if you've got little or no funds? Thank you. Knowledge is power. That's from Sean.
Well, hello, Sean. I want to first and foremost wish you luck in your endeavors. I can tell you that if you're looking to pursue a career in neurosurgery, you have to first and foremost have a keen interest in the nervous system. And then you have to be able to withstand a very long and rigorous training procedure. When I was in training, it was upwards of 6 years. It's now a 7-year program, notwithstanding 4 years of medical school, 4 years of college, internship, so on and so forth. If you're in psychology, obviously you're into the brain, and that might be a little easier transition for someone not interested in the brain. But still, there's a big difference between psychiatry, psychology, neurology, and neurosurgery. So my advice to you would be, first and foremost, get involved with a physician, tag along with them, follow them, make sure that this is the career path that you might want to consider, get a feel for their lifestyle and what they do on a daily basis. Do that early, and then you can make a much more intelligent decision as to whether or not you would like to pursue this form of training or education.
Okay, thanks a lot. All right, now we'll go to Ivy in New Paltz. Okay, Ivy in New Paltz, you're on.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, sure. Doctor. I'm calling because my son has Tourette's, and it's generally manageable. There he goes in the background there. But sometimes it gets kind of bad, and I know that some people with very serious Tourette's have been helped with surgical procedures. And I was just wondering if there's any kind of a way that would help somebody who maybe isn't so severe that, you know, they can't function. I do worry about him, you know, leaving to go off to college and still trying to deal with the Tourette's.
Yes. I'm assuming you've tried and have exhausted all of the medical or medication parameters. Is that correct?
Well, we've tried lots of different things, and they work in, you know, sometimes they work really well, and then sometimes they stop working. We have to tweak the medicines and try different things.
Yes, I would, again, being a neurosurgeon, in my opinion, I think there's very limited form of surgical options offered to the Tourette's patient at this time. However, what I would do is I would find a functional neurosurgeon, i.e. a neurosurgeon that specializes in deep brain stimulation. And I would have a consultation with them to decide whether or not he is a surgical candidate. But again, from my standpoint, there's very limited treatment options surgically for patients with Tourette's.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. We'll go to Paul in Chatham. Okay, Paul in Chatham.
Hello?
Hello.
This is Paul.
That's right. I know that. Go ahead. What do you got?
Oh, good. Okay, I am 73. My wife is 70. We're in very good health. We do yoga. We eat healthy foods, et cetera, et cetera. And I go to a cardiologist. I've been seeing him for the last 15 years, who does Boston Heart deep dish. I call it deep dish blood analytics. And he, the reason I went to him originally was because I was feeling sluggish and I was couldn't keep focus, and he discovered through the blood analytics that I had an allergy to yeast. Well, that was, like, terrific. It changed it all. So I've been going to him for about 15 years, every 6 months or 3 months, just to keep on top of things.
Hey, Paul? Paul, listen, you got to get – we've got a lot of people on the line, so you got to get to your question as fast as you can. Go ahead.
I'm there. He identified in the last time I went to see him that I have a high level of aluminum showing up in my system, and he doesn't know where it's coming from, and I haven't been able to find out. And uniquely enough, my wife went to see him about 2 months after that for herself, and she also had aluminum in her system. Where can this possibly be coming from?
Okay, this is political scientist Alan. I want to ask you a question. Do you use Rolaids by any chance?
Rolaids?
Yes.
No.
Okay, go ahead, Doc.
Neither one of us use.
Well, Paul, as Alan alluded to, you know, again, I don't know where this comes from a neurosurgical perspective, because I don't treat aluminum overdoses. However, what I think Alan was alluding to is that many over-the-counter preparations for GERD or heartburn contain aluminum products, magnesium, aluminum. And the question is that could you be exposed to a high intake of these products? There are certain medications and certain procedures that can be done, like chelating treatment, which is way beyond the neurosurgical perspective, that you might need to be looking into. But
chelating.
Sir?
Did you call it chelating?
Again, chelation therapy is one a form of treatment whereby chelating agents can be used to chelate or grab onto the metals that might be in your system.
Okay. We don't use anything in everything we do ingest. We look carefully at the ingredients, and nothing is given a clue.
Okay.
In any category, whether it's for stomach or for anything like that, we just don't.
Yeah, do you cook with aluminum pots? I don't know what your water system is like. I don't know what intake. I don't know if you take a lot of Rolaids. I don't know. You know, there are many potential issues here.
Yeah, okay, I understand. And we have tested the water, and the water is fine. We don't use aluminum pots. We don't use aluminum in deodorant or anything like that. So it's a real mystery. Where is it coming from?
Good luck to you, Paul. Okay, we're going to Richard in Whitesboro. All right, Richard, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I was just wondering, I have idiopathic peripheral neuropathy, and I was wondering what the doctor would do if he had it and he wanted to, and you had explored all the tests and so on. They just had an inconclusive Lyme test, but that's about it. And I was just wondering if there's any other facilities or type of doctor or research place to go and pursue a final cause or potential cause?
The first thing I want to say, and then over to doctor, is the definition of the word idiopathic means we don't know. Is that right?
Right.
He hit the nail on the head. I was going to start the conversation off by saying by the term idiopathic, we don't know the cause of. So he hit it exactly. Now, having said that, there is a litany of potential medical and or surgical issues that can cause a peripheral neuropathy. But because you're telling me, or because I heard you say idiopathic, by definition, we don't know. However, what I would do is, if you've exhausted all of your blood assays and you've gone to a neurologist and they've done procedures, i.e. EMG, nerve conduction velocity studies, and they haven't found anything, then I would make sure that there's not a structural cause for this, i.e. spinal stenosis, neural compression in the foramen, which is the opening where the nerve root comes out of the spinal canal. Could there be a peripheral tumor somehow on the nerve root? So I would look into those things if you've exhausted all of the other blood workup.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome,
sir. I
do
have one of those.
Thank you, Richard. Okay. And now on to David in Belchertown. Okay. David in Belchertown, you're on.
Hello. How you doing? I'll try to be concise.
Great.
I ended up involved in a traffic accident, broke my C5 and 6. Afterward, they did a fusion. I wonder what the prognosis was in arthritis, things like that. Only because I'm asking is because in the last like week or two, I've had a pretty substantial neck pain, but I'm extremely active and never had this issue before. I wondered if it was something related or is it just arthritis?
Now, Doc, C5 and 6 is up there towards the neck, right?
Yes, sir. That's about the mid to low third of the neck.
Okay, so answering his question.
So you had a fracture of both the C5 and C6 vertebral body, and my understanding is that you had a fusion.
Right.
Now, the question in my mind is, did you have any arthritic changes prior to the accident? And if you did, that would tell me that the likelihood of you developing arthritic conditions later on is higher than someone who doesn't have an arthritic condition, number one. Number
okay.
two.
I was younger. So
okay. Well, I don't know.
Now.
You're
like
59. So I
ago.
Can almost guarantee you you
55,
have.
55 now, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I would almost guarantee that you have some arthritic changes in your neck anyway, just on the basis of the normal aging process. However, because you had a fusion, that does put you at increased risk for something called adjacent level disease. And that would make the area around C4-5 or C6-7 potentially be a problem later on. And because 5-6 and 6-7 are the two main areas in the neck that have the majority of movement next to the atlas and axis, which is C1 and C2, you could potentially be at risk for what we call adjacent level disease.
Does that mean that will fail?
Not necessarily. It just means that the adjacent levels might become at risk in the future. Not
under
that
stress.
The fusion itself would fail. You would have known by now if
That's
it failed.
That's what I was worried about.
Yeah. That doesn't
okay,
mean you will,
you.
By the way.
Okay, thanks a lot. So let me see if I get this right, Frank, if I can. If adjacent means the one above or the one below, right?
The one next to above or below, correct.
Right. So if you have this disease and or any of that and they fix it, then it may mean that you're going to get that there will be an affect to the next one, as in the foot bone is attached to the ankle bone.
Well, possibly and likely. However, if you're 20 years old and fell off a bike or was involved in a motor vehicle accident or was involved in a car accident and you blew out one specific disc, does that mean you're at increased risk later on for the adjacent levels? Well, maybe, maybe not. But that's a totally different situation than if you're 60, 70, and have what we call a degenerative disc condition and have issues there. So even though they're related, they're indirectly related, so to speak.
Okay, we're going to try to get some more in here. Phyllis in Scotia. Phyllis, you're going to have to be real quick here.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. In 2013, I had diagnosed with severe stenosis, and then I had a laminectomy on my L4, L5 that, by the way, I would highly recommend. I woke up in recovery with virtually no pain, and prior to that had 4 months of sheer agony. I now have late-stage ovarian cancer. I was diagnosed last year. I was given chemo, and as a result of the chemo, I have sensory neuropathy in my feet and my hands. And now I have also developed a pain back in my butt, like a sciatic pain. I'm wondering, is it possible that due to the laminectomy, that nerve is now forever compromised and sensitive?
Okay, we have to stop.
Or is it possible?
Well, we have to stop there because we're going to be running out of time. You're going to be in the middle of the news.
Okay.
Give me a one-minute answer.
Okay, Phyllis, I'm sorry about the ovarian cancer. However, with regards to the laminectomy, it can be scar tissue that's forming. Nonetheless, because you had chemotherapy, the question is that affecting? Did that affect the nerve? And it sounds like it did. So the two different problems.
Okay.
Thank you.
It could affect my sciatic nerve as well.
It's possible, but just by virtue of the scar tissue alone.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're
so
welcome.
Sorry to Brendan in Schenectady. Best option for disc replacement, he wants to know. Jessica from Niskayuna, we're heading to a Long Island to celebrate graduation. Janet from East Nassau, cervical spine surgery, and we're out of time, and I so apologize. I want to thank Dr. Frank Genovese for Ellis Hospital for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Landis Arboretum, Esperance, New York, announcing Spring Plant Benefit this Saturday and Sunday, May 20th and 21st, 10 a.m. through 4 p.m., LandisArboretum.org. Thanks to our engineer, the incomparable Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones and giving me the signals. Our producer's Jim Lavoulis on Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.